from KQED.
This is the California Report. This week, Governor Jerry Brown urges the state to ease up on its get-tough-on-crime mindset.
Over the passage of time, men change, women change, and those changes ought to be accommodated so that we can open up the cells for new people that are even more dangerous.
And all this warm weather we're having is not good for the state's snowpack. Also, Palm Springs is hot for lovers of modern architecture.
Tract housing doesn't have to all look alike. And tract housing doesn't have to be just boxes with holes in the walls for a window.
Plus, we'll talk about a power couple in Santa Cruz using art to save the planet.
We made a decision to do no work that did not benefit the ecology, as neither of us could face that alone. And that's how our collaboration began.
I'm Rachel Miro, and this is the California Report. We begin today with Governor Jerry Brown, who's been pressing to reform criminal sentencing in California with an eye to reducing the state's prison population. Scott Schaefer, senior editor of our California Politics and Government desk, got a chance to sit down with Brown to talk about it, and he joins us here in studio. Scott, thank you for being here.
Happy to be here.
Well, the governor doesn't offer these opportunities to chat one-on-one often, does he?
No, he doesn't really, but this is an issue that is near and dear to him. This has been a hallmark of his time as governor, this second time around, criminal justice reform. He has, of course, created this realignment program where counties now have more responsibility for low-level offenders. And he's been thinking about this really since he was mayor of Oakland, in particular a law that he signed back the first time he was governor, some 40 years ago, and he feels that that was an abysmal failure. That's his phrase. And so now he wants to talk about this proposal to change what he did way back in 1976.
It's interesting that you point out, you know, he had a hand in creating this penal code that he now criticizes. One of the things he said to you in this conversation is that the state went on a kind of a rampage, revising the penal code over the last 40 years. What does he mean by that?
Well, when he was governor, he signed this law called the Uniform Determinate Sentencing Law. And he says he did that because there were complaints that the parole board was showing racial bias, that when people of color would come before them to get out of prison early to go on to parole, that they were getting longer and longer sentences. They were being denied parole. And so he said he signed this bill to bring some certainty and uniformity to the sentencing laws, but there were all these unintended consequences because people ended up staying in prison for longer and longer and longer, and the prison population exploded. And, you know, he just feels that that needs to be undone, and that's what he's trying to do. Now, part of what this entails is taking power away from prosecutors and giving it to the parole board, which he appoints, and he feels now is much more sensitive and closer to what the inmates are doing in terms of rehabilitating themselves. And so this is how he responds to this notion that maybe prosecutors have had too much power.
The proposition of the DAs is, we know on the day we charge or on the day of the judge sentences, everything that can occur, we know all we need to know for the next 50 years. But over the passage of time, men change, women change, and those changes ought to be accommodated so that we can open up the cells for new people that are even more dangerous.
And so, Rachel, prosecutors are generally not in favor of anything that would loosen laws or shorten sentences or let criminals out of jail or prison faster. And, you know, as you can imagine, they are opposing this.
Well, what are they doing specifically to tackle his moves?
Well, they came out this week with two things. One, their board voted to oppose the measure, but then they filed a writ of mandate with the Sacramento court on Thursday that seeks to block the Attorney General, Kamala Harris, from even giving this ballot measure a title and summary because they say what he did was he took a measure that had been submitted earlier on juvenile justice, gutted and amended it to create this new ballot measure, which they say is not just little tiny changes. This is a whole fundamentally different ballot measure. And so they want him to go back to the beginning instead of what they say is jumping ahead of the line. And so this is going to be played out in court. The court hasn't decided yet whether they're going to take up this challenge.
Does his avowed Catholicism play into this at all?
Well, Jerry Brown was trained as a Jesuit. He's long been against the death penalty. He studied with Mother Teresa. And I asked him about that. How has your religion and your thinking about second chances influenced your decision to come forward with this ballot measure?
The essence of Christianity is redemption. That's Jesus Christ, the Redeemer. That's what it's all about. So those who say, once you commit certain crimes, you are forever, for 10, 20, 30, 50, 70, 80 years, that's it. That really does run afoul of not only Christianity, but our whole American tradition, and just plain common sense.
And Rachel, this ballot measure he's proposing only is aimed at nonviolent offenders, but the governor indicated he would have been open to allowing some people who were in prison for violent crimes to get this second chance as well. However, that was clearly what he, as he says, a non-starter. No one was really willing to go out on a limb and support that.
Scott, always a pleasure talking with you.
Good to talk with you.
That's Scott Schaefer, senior editor of our California Politics and Government desk. It was a warm, dry week across California. Enjoyable, yes, but not so good for replenishing the state's water supplies. As KQED science reporter Lauren Summer tells us, warmer winters are putting the state's water supply at risk.
With every winter storm that hits California, there's an invisible line, a line that plays a huge role in our water supply. It's the place where rain turns into snow, and I got in the car and went looking for it.
It looks like the snow is getting a lot heavier. I'm driving out of the Sierra Nevada mountains right now. I'm about 7,000 feet on Donner Summit.
Half an hour later down I-80, I'd found it.
You definitely need an umbrella right now. It's big raindrops, and we're about 5,500 feet. So everything above us elevation is snow, but everything below is rain.
But in some storms, this freezing point is a lot higher up, like in December.
Good morning from Donner Summit, where it is raining. It's been raining all morning since we got here, and that means down here on the roadway, just a lot of slush on the road.
That's not good news, says Kelly Redmond.
Not all precipitation is created equal.
Redmond studies the snowpack at the Desert Research Institute in Reno. Snow, he says, is just better behaved than rain.
When it falls as snow, it stays there. It doesn't run off. It doesn't cause floods.
It's locked away, stored in the mountains.
It's like a free reservoir.
And just when we need it, the snow melts.
And shows up in the rivers and in our faucets in the summer months.
This timing is crucial, Redmond says. The snowpack feeds about a third of the state's water supply. So water officials, understandably, keep a very close eye on it.
What I'm going to do is take a sample here.
Every month, Frank Gerke of the Department of Water Resources heads out to a spot south of Lake Tahoe. He measures the snow by sinking a long metal tube into it.
I'm going to keep on going.
The snowpack looks pretty good this year so far, above average. But if rain falls on it, it would melt some of what's already here, like happened last year when it was a really warm winter.
Way above normal in temperature, beyond anything we've ever seen before.
Redmond says for the first time ever recorded, the coldest winter temperatures in the Sierra last year were above freezing on average. And forecasters say this winter will also likely be warm.
It doesn't take much warming to switch from rain to snow.
The nickname for California snow is Sierra Cement. Our snow is always wet and heavy, on the brink of becoming rain.
We're in an era of just unprecedented changes.
Dan Kahan studies climate change at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography and the U.S. Geological Survey. He says the past few warm winters have given us a snapshot of the future.
I think this has been kind of a wake-up call.
Kahan says California's snowpack has already shrunk by 10% on average since World War II. And as the climate keeps warming,
by the end of the century, if we're lucky, we'll only lose half. And if we're unlucky, we could lose more than that.
It really does change the dynamic.
That's Mark Cowan, who, as the director of California's Department of Water Resources, has to figure out how to handle less snow and more rain. Some people say that means building more reservoirs.
Of course, there's always been interest in dams. They're big, you can see them. But the fact is, we're not going to appreciably change the amount of reservoir capacity we have in California.
There simply aren't many good places left for dams, he says. Instead, we'll need to do other things, like storing more water underground, preparing for floods, and using water more efficiently. All of that costs money.
We could spend $100 billion over the next decade or two pretty easily, even more than that.
California's recent water bond will help with that, but at just $7 billion, it's really, and here comes the water metaphor, only a drop in the bucket. For the California Report, I'm Lauren Sommer.
Next up, a trip to Palm Springs.
A dry, sun-baked plain lying at the foot of towering mountains. Palm Springs, California, a modern little winter resort city that came to be known as the playground of the stars.
Today, Palm Springs is just as famous for its treasure trove of mid-century modern architecture. This week, the walls of glass and elegantly simple open floor plans of the post-war period will be on display. The 11th annual Modernism Week is expected to draw thousands of visitors. Matt Gillum of KVZR has the story.
Full disclosure, I'm a big fan of modernism. I like the optimism of the late 1950s it evokes. I like how it's both a part of a bygone era, but incredibly of the moment. Its focus on the whole space just resonates with me. It's no wonder Chris Menrad's house in Palm Springs is something of a favorite.
So we're in the backyard of my 1957 design William Kreisel butterfly roofline house in the neighborhood of Twin Palms.
We're sitting on the patio by the pool. Menrad is a realtor and preservationist. His modest post and beam constructed house is part of a housing tract from the late 50s called Twin Palms. What stands out most about the dusty, cactus-colored home aren't its simple lines or high windows, it's the roof.
This one is very joyous because it's sort of reaching up on either end to the sky. I remember when I first saw it from the main highway, I saw a bit of it and I just always thought, oh, it was like the fins of a Cadillac, an old Cadillac car. That's how it kind of looked to me.
Menrad is more than a fan of modernism. He just co-edited a new book on William Kreisel.
I did some with flat roofs, some with gable roofs, some with shed roofs, and some with butterfly roofs. Now, in Twin Palms, there are 8 different models, but they're all the same floor plan, and I rotate them and turn them in to get different looks.
Kreisel is the architect behind Twin Palms. He remembers exactly how he laid out the development almost 60 years ago to ensure it looked nothing like a housing tract, even though it was. I met the 91-year-old at his condo in Beverly Hills. He's funny, charming, and maintains a fastidiously kept white mustache. He started by telling me about growing up in Shanghai.
Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek, who was president of China, lived across the street from us, and we were friends with him and Madame Zhang.
In the mid-1930s, Kreisel came back to the U.S. Later, he studied architecture at USC. He never lived in Palm Springs, but he made his way to the desert in the 50s, where he started designing housing tracts for the Alexander Construction Company.
Tract housing doesn't have to all look alike. And tract housing doesn't have to be just boxes with holes in the walls for a window. You can have walls of glass and you can have all the good design elements that I wanted in architecture.
What Kreisel wanted in architecture, a flow between the inside and the outside, that resonated with the people who first bought in Twin Palms.
The people that came were substantial business and professional people from Los Angeles, San Diego, San Francisco, Canada. The men wore 3-piece suits and they drove a 4-door black sedan, everything very conservative. And when they came to Palm Springs, it was like, I'm a different person. They put on walking shorts. They bought a convertible to keep down there. They got a golf bag.
You could get a tract house in Twin Palms with a pool, an air conditioner, and an open floor plan for $30,000 in the late 50s. Today, the modest homes that helped launch the concept of California living go for close to $500,000. It's Kreisel's work in the desert that changed the perception that designing tract housing was below serious architects. Back by the pool in Palm Springs, Chris Menrad says Kreisel's work to shift that perception illustrates his brilliance.
Really, his genius is probably really bringing modernism to the masses. He liked to work with developers and tried to get his ideas into as many people's hands as possible.
Simplicity, openness, and functionality in design, they've resonated with the people of Palm Springs. Kreisel is being honored by the desert city whose look he helped define. During Modernism Week, they'll rename a street after him.
People who have bought my houses or have anything that I've designed in the desert know they have something special.
Kreisel is still keeping busy with the homes he built in the desert nearly six decades ago. He consults with buyers who want to restore his homes to their original condition. Before I leave his condo, Kreisel takes me through my copy of the new book about him and tells me the story behind a lot of the photos and drawings. He signs it, "Thank you for a delightful afternoon. Hope we meet again." I do too. For the California Report, I'm Matt Gillum.
Valentine's Day approaches. These days, it's not enough to line up a restaurant reservation. You have to post proof of the date online. And if your darling does, you'd better like it. Today, as part of Love in the Digital Age, our occasional series on the way technology affects human relationships, I brought in Rico Galliano, co-host of the radio show and podcast Dinner Party Download, for a heart-to-heart about privacy.
We all, on some level, understand whether we actually, you know, consciously acknowledge it or not. The way that people behave in the world may not necessarily jibe with the way that they behave in their private lives, that those are two different universes, and that as long as the public life is on a certain level legal and the public life is on a certain level transparent, the private life is kind of yours to do with what you will.
I think we grew up with the expectation that the private would be private. But I think social media has upended that. I mean, you know, folks are sharing everything online. Here's my next meal. Here's my last meal. There's almost nothing we don't share with others online.
I think people think of the social media world as just an expansion of their, you know, normal social lives in some way. But it isn't to me. There are plenty of people who look at my Facebook page that are not my close friends, that I don't want to tell them about my relationships or know exactly what I'm doing with my, you know, significant other. And yet I feel like there is the expectation that you do that. And not only is it almost impossible if you know, for you to control it, but also it can cause problems with the person that you're dating. Because there's now an expectation that there will be a certain amount of evidence of a relationship happening in social media. And if there isn't, then what is that saying about your relationship? Are you trying to keep our relationship on the down low? You don't want anyone to know that we're dating? Are you saying that you want me to be your dirty little secret? And I'm sure everybody listening has had this conversation at some point with somebody that they've dated or in a relationship with. That moment where it's like, hey, do we press the relationship button? Is it okay if I press the relationship button? Do strangers need to know that we're in a relationship?
What happens if you break up and then you get back together again? And
yes.
Then if you never hit that button, you don't have to have that conversation or that concern about what the status is communicating ever.
Yeah. I was briefly married. And it's like when you put like engaged or just married or something like that, it's amazing. You do it and you want to tell everyone and there's 5,000 comments and everybody's like, so happy for you guys, multiple exclamation points. When the marriage was over, just very secretly in the dead of night, that relationship just changed. Nothing said. And in retrospect, therefore, it feels like that first explosion of like, hooray, kind of feels like maybe we shouldn't have made such a big deal out of it. I don't know.
And yet I suppose that's life, you know. You do feel passionate about things. You charge, you know, headlong and into the fray with all kinds of enthusiasm and optimism and passion. And if things go badly, they go badly. But that, you know, doesn't mean you were a bad person. Or
thank you for saying so.
I would want the same understanding for myself.
You've got it.
Okay.
Next time that happens, I have total sympathy. There's nothing you can do about what other people do, or there's little that you can do about what other people do. I've had conversations with dates before where it's like, hey, can we not talk about this on social media for a while for X, Y, and Z reasons? And I think a lot of people are cool with it on some level because I think everybody realizes this. It's like you don't broadcast that you're going on a first or second date with someone because that's creepy and weird, for instance.
I will say, though, but I mean, several dates in, some people kind of think that you are being paranoid or that you're full of yourself, thinking other people are watching every move you make and really care at all.
What do you think about that? Do you think that that's a legitimate thing, that you're being paranoid? I don't think that that's true. I think people are watching.
People are gossips. It's been this way since the beginning of time, since long before the internet. And, you know, they kind of turn to their own friends and family as a form of entertainment. And so, yeah, if you don't want that level of oversight and judgment, then it behooves you to sort of keep it offline.
Yeah, but can you? I mean, this is what we keep coming back to, is to what extent do you have any control over this anymore?
Very little. And I think that think that changes the way we behave offline, too, because we're aware we're being watched.
I've had breakups where it's like, I'm going to keep following you on Facebook because I still like and respect you. And there are times when that's been said and I'm kind of like, really? I don't want you to keep doing that.
I'd rather.
I don't think that's a great idea for either of us. Yeah, but what do you say? I mean, you can always, I guess you can unfollow that person, but how does that work? I'm trying to think of it. If you unfriend somebody on Facebook.
Yeah. I mean, they'll still see you if you're connected in other ways. And I suppose it is up to every individual how they feel about their past loves.
I think that that's true. And I guess you can only make that decision for yourself, right?
Well, Rico, what a pleasure talking with you. We could keep this up forever, I think, but I know you've
it's
got a
true.
Busy romantic life to lead outside of the studio.
Not so busy. There's nothing. Just please don't check my Facebook page. Nothing to see there.
That was Rico Galliano of the Dinner Party Download. Look for the latest episode of Love in the Digital Age on iTunes or wherever you download your podcasts.
Support for the California Report comes from Barracuda Networks, innovators of network security and data protection solutions designed to thwart cyber threats and data loss for businesses of all sizes. Learn more at barracuda.com/KQED. Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org. And the California Endowment, working to achieve health and justice for all. Learn more at calendow.org.
When a marriage works, it's a beautiful thing. For decades, Newton and Helen Mayer Harrison have used art to tackle ecological problems on a massive global scale. KQED's senior arts editor Chloe Veltman brings us a profile of a couple of artists who not only have an enduring love for each other, but also the planet.
When Helen and Newton Harrison first met, they weren't just taken with each other's looks.
What happened was very simple. We met and we talked from the very beginning.
She was smarter than me, and I was smarter than her. We figured 20 to 30 years from now, we'd still be talking to one another.
Their passion for conversation soon led the couple to a passion for the environment.
We made a decision to do no work that did not benefit the ecology, as neither of us could face that alone. And that's how our collaboration began.
The world-renowned artists call Santa Cruz home, and they've used their work to inspire the public to get behind environmental causes and helped to bring about policy change. Right now, the Harrisons are tackling global warming head-on with a project that spans three continents and four sites. One of the sites is at the UC Berkeley Sage Hen Creek Field Station in the eastern Sierra Nevada. I toured it recently in a snowmobile with scientist Jeff Brown. There wasn't much to see under the snow, let alone anything that resembled art.
But even when you see it in the summer, it's a black fence around a bunch of little plants.
At Sage Hen, the Harrisons are collaborating with Brown's team and members of the Washoe tribe on a 50-year-long project. It involves physically moving groups of plant species like wild rose and red fir to higher ground. The aim is to help the seedlings become resilient to the warming effects of climate change. Brown says the Harrisons' art, like the huge, colourful, topographical maps they create for many of their projects, helps to transform cold scientific data into a meaningful story.
They're allowed to get visceral. You know, they're allowed to get emotive. They're allowed to connect with people in ways that science just can't.
This quality has enabled the Harrisons to shape environmental policy. In the mid-1990s, a branch of the Dutch government challenged the artists to solve an enormous urban planning problem: how to build hundreds of thousands of new houses while protecting the country's lush green lowlands. The Harrisons created beautiful aerial landscape videos to bewitch the initially sceptical officials and audaciously exhibited a big map of Holland printed backwards.
And the planners got mad at us and they said, "Why have you done this?" And we said, "Well, you're planning your country backwards, so we printed your map backwards."
The American couple wowed the Dutch officials, who eventually adopted the plan. Bill Fox runs the Center for Art and the Environment at the Museum of Nevada. He says the Harrisons' work is persuasive because it successfully bridges the worlds of politics and science.
They create these beautiful maps and poetic texts do these exhibitions about the problem. That creates that empathy for a place. But once you begin to care about a place, you will care about what happens to that place.
Sometimes the couple's art has gotten them into trouble. In 1971, the Harrisons were part of a high-profile exhibition in London. For their installation about the sustainability of farming practices, they electrocuted catfish and made stew for museum-goers. It caused an uproar. Helen says that although the fish were humanely killed, many people couldn't see past the shock value.
People wanted the government to cancel our show.
The tabloid press went berserk. Newton lights up at the memory.
Helen had made an odd version of a bouillabaisse. It smelled so good that nobody went to the other exhibitions.
A composer even turned the debacle into an opera 2 years ago, with Newton Harrison and the catfish among the characters represented on stage.
A special meeting of the Arts Council determined that for close the exhibition would interfere with artistic freedom.
The Harrisons are in their 80s now. They aren't as mobile as they used to be, and Helen's health is fragile. They're still doggedly focused on their ecological mission, showcased in an upcoming book which Random House will publish later this year. Though Newton cautions it's not up to him and Helen to save the Earth.
You need a big community. And that community is slowly forming, and the question is, will it form quickly enough?
Still, the Harrisons hope the seedlings hibernating under the snow in the Sierra Nevada will help in a small way to forestall disaster. For the California Report, I'm Chloe Veltman.
I'm Lexi Berry at Charles Chocolates here in San Francisco, and I am the kitchen manager here.
Valentine's Day is coming up.
Yes, a busy time for us. You've been listening to The California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. The technical producer is Seal Muller. Our engineers are Howard Gelman and Danny Bringer. The online team includes David Marks, David Weir, Lisa Pickoff-White, and Olivia Allen Price. Our interns are Alex Swulinski and Nicole West. The California Report's editorial team includes Victoria Malleone, Polly Stryker, Ingrid Becker, Kat Snow, and Holly Kernan.
And I'm Rachel Miro. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Support for the California Report comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. More at irvine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.